For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, two of your favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle. And gentlemen, you know, cave dwelling puts you close to the earth.
It
puts you close to the environment.
Might even put you in the earth.
Well, as long as you're living in the cave and not under the cave, I think you're okay.
Right.
So the question is, a lot of discussion has come up recently about environmentalism. Now, we as Catholics are called to be good stewards of the earth, and a lot of people refer to the earth as Mother Earth. Well, we as Catholics believe that Mary is our mother. Earth just happens to be the place that we live. How do we as Catholics approach environmentalism and the care for the earth and the environment in a way that sticks to Catholic doctrine and still meets the needs of keeping our air, water, and food clean?
Well, I think a way for us to begin is, I like to go back sometimes to the beginning. So I'd like maybe a place to start is to consider from a Catholic perspective where the earth comes from, what comes from creation. In other words, I think we have to acknowledge that God's the creator of heaven and earth. And of us, but the physical universe and all of its goods are actually the product of God's love for us, and He's entrusted the earth to us.
And for eons, that was relatively non-controversial, and that's still non-controversial. It's not like there's a lot of people arguing with that. But you know, if you want to get back to the beginning, you don't have to go quite so far. You have to get back to the beginning of environmentalism and the environmental movement and kind of where that came from, because
that's far more contemporary, you know, I would think.
Well, yeah, because if you go back and you read St. Augustine or you read St. Thomas Aquinas, or, you know, even
two of our heroes,
I would say even John Henry Newman, you know, if you read them, they're not talking about the environment. There's not a lot of environmentalism tucked in there unless you kind of, you know, scratch around the surface a little bit to look at it. So it wasn't a topic that was of concern for Augustine or St. Thomas Aquinas. And it's not like there wasn't pollution going on at that point either. You know, nor was it really, I would say, that they were completely indifferent to the idea of stewardship and that, you know, creation came, you know, from God and therefore we have a responsibility to take care of it. You know, I think that's all kind of tucked in. But the controversy of environmentalism comes as a modern controversy, and it only comes up in the context of modern thought. And I think to a certain extent, you know, when you're peeling back what the Catholic reaction to environmentalism is, you have to see where it came from. You have to see what this movement is, what the problems are that it's dealing with, what the issues are that it's putting forward, and kind of what the solutions are that it's proposing for these problems.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack there, Mark. let's get going, because we only have an hour.
All right, so let's start with environmentalism. And, you know, I think to understand anything, you have to understand what questions it's trying to answer. Mm-hmm. And so the central questions that environmentalism and the whole environmental movement seems to be trying to ask is, what responsibilities, what are our duties that we have towards the natural environment around us? And and to a certain extent, you know, what's the purpose of the earth? What's it there for? Is it there for us to use, to exploit, to wrench and twist and turn and experiment with and try to eke out its secrets and make it cry mercy so that we humans can get as much out of it as we need to? Is that what it's there for? Is stewardship a process of taking care of it so that we can use it better? Or is stewardship a process of us standing back and not using the environment, not using the resources that are there so that we can have happy animals and we can have, you know, happy nature, and that we can have, you know, this sort of get back to the Garden of Eden idea where we're not really relying on nature all that much but simply, you know, kind of what's most ready at hand. Those are a lot of questions to ask, but then, you know, what is that central question, I guess, that we're getting at when we're talking about environmentalism?
I'm not sure there's a single answer to that. It seems to me part of what gives rise to the contemporary environmental movement is industrialization. I think that's part of it, because with industrialization, you have at least a couple of features that kind of stand out in my mind. One is you're going to see a high density of population as people, especially take on things like factory work. So you're going to have people moving. Well, you have industrialization. You see it in China a lot. You have people moving from rural areas into cities and building larger and larger cities. And so with the dense population often comes a certain strain on natural resources, because people use a lot of natural resources. So when you have higher density, you're going to have other things, like with the concern to the second thing I would say, which is related, which is you also have waste.
Right.
So you have waste. One of the hallmarks that's necessary for human flourishing is you need to have good sanitation, as an example. I mean, even the Romans discovered that. I mean, that was one of the things that set them apart, is that they actually had the beginning of sanitation. So a way in which to, you know, sort of safely dispose of human waste, whether that's biological waste or material waste that we produce.
Yeah, sanitation's an interesting aspect when you start looking at environmental science and environmentalism, et cetera, because the ultimate cause, I think, of a tremendous amount of waste in human history, we would consider natural. You know, if you went back to 15th, 16th century London, for instance, it would be a filthy place, and it would seem really dirty to us. But that's because there's no cars. So we think of cars as these massive polluting machines, and they tend to be. I don't think there's much argument about that. But you don't think of the amount of waste that horses and all that goes along with a horse-based economy is going to create, and all of problems, you know, pollution-wise sure. and waste-wise, and the Thames River was probably just utterly disgusting when you think about it, because of simply they were relying on horses and not cars. And yet, I think a lot of environmentalists would say, well, you know, that would be a good thing, relying more on horses and not cars, because they're not putting as much, you know, unnatural pollution into the air. So that pollution thing, it's an interesting question. What constitutes pollution? How do we decide what really is a pollutant? How do we decide what's natural, what's unnatural? But that's all just based on, as you said, you know, people tending to be drawn to the cities more, and with that, them bringing their animals, their waste, and all that goes along with more people living together in one place.
Yeah, there's that. And then the other thing that I think is happening with industrialization is you also, again, have a higher, you have a concentration of, and actually I think new kinds of waste that are being produced as technology advances. So just to point to one industry, plastics. So when plastics come into existence, the manufacturing of plastics creates a completely new kind of waste that has to be contended with. And so you begin to, I think in the environmental movement, contemporary environmental movement, you begin to have certain kinds of byproducts of industrialization, waste products, or just the acquisition of, say, the necessary materials for production, then are identified or seen as threats to the ecosystem.
Right. And I think that's an important part of philosophically peeling this back, is industrialization is based on our ability to create. It's based on our ability for making more and more things. And as we're making more and more of these things are, I think, further removed from their raw products that are going into them. So when you wind up with plastic, it's far removed from the natural minerals and things that you need to cultivate and collect.
Well, you don't see them hanging off tree branches.
Exactly. You're not just
harvest baggies.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
the orchard.
And you're not
you gotta make them.
Yeah, you're not just running a bunch of leaves and trees through a mill to create, you know, lumber for building houses. Right. You know, it's a much
more
involved process.
You need steel. You need I-beams.
Right. And so, you know, the question becomes, to what extent as makers are we making things that are antagonistic to nature rather than friendly to nature? So it puts human beings in a different sort of relationship with the environment around us than what we previously had before we became these mass producers that industrialization allowed.
Well, I think that points out maybe one of the basic assumptions that's a part of, often I think a very frequent part of an environmentalist conversation or schema would be that there exists a kind of natural balance within the biosphere, and human beings and certain activities tend to disrupt that balance. And so when a car adds carbon monoxide into the atmosphere, it's seen as disruptive to the natural balance of the atmosphere. And therefore, that is seen as something bad, that the natural balance is what ought to be preserved. And anything that disrupts that balance is typically seen as something to be avoided.
Right. And there's a presupposition involved in that, and that is that what human beings produce, what we make, is by definition unnatural. So, you know, if you're putting something natural into a natural system, you're just kind of contributing to what that natural system does. If you put something unnatural into it, then you're going to be disturbing its balance. You're artificially manipulating it. And so the presupposition is that humans, by nature, are unnatural, are having unnatural effects, are doing things.
Impacts, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
And are producing agents and creating things that don't belong in nature, aren't part of nature. So, you know, we look at it and we say, well, plastic, that's not a natural object because human beings produced it. Well, that's a philosophical presupposition. And, you know, it may or may not be correct, because human beings, as rational animals, we are part of our environment. And I think, you know, the effect that we have on our environment, you know, like, for instance, a beaver dam. You know, a beaver dam can have tremendous, you know, ecological effects downstream. They're not necessarily always healthy for an environment, but they're not considered unnatural because they're created by beavers.
Right.
Whereas anything that's created by human beings, we don't have that same recognition that, well, you know, beavers are part of this ecosystem. Beavers live here. They have their houses. And so when they build their dams, even though it's going to have adverse effects for a lot of other species, it's still natural. We jump pretty quickly to that understanding of anything human beings do, that's almost by definition unnatural.
And we need to take a break, and we'll be back with more of a look at environmentalism here on the Catholic Cave. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Renewing minds.
Got my eyes off my worries and onto God.
Transforming lives.
It's amazing that one word can just transform you, that word that you want to hear.
Catholic Radio Indy.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford, and we are talking today about environmentalism. And, you know, somewhere down at the end of this show, lurking at the end of our cave here, there is an answer to the question of what really is a Catholic stance in regard to environmentalism and the environmental movement and all of the questions and controversies that come up, because they're fairly complex questions.
Yes.
And, you know,
the answers are pretty complex too.
The answers are pretty complex. And so I think we should say right off the bat that, you know, what is the Catholic response? Well, I'm not sure there really is one. And, you know, the church tends to approach controversial issues like this, or contemporary issues, or really what the church sees as political issues, by saying what we need are faithful lay Catholics guided by the Holy Spirit, guided by a prayer life, to use their expertise, to use their knowledge to sort these things out. And it doesn't fall under the purview really of theology or something that the church is going to speak to directly. Now, there have been encyclicals that have addressed environmental problems.
Laudato si.
Right, exactly. And so there's been, but honestly, the nature of Laudato si, when you look at it, is to, I think, point the laity in the direction of where the Holy Father sees the problems. But, you know, you go
it
back.
It lays out principles, I think.
Yeah, it lays out principles. But you go back to Gaudium et Spes, and Gaudium et Spes is pretty clear in Vatican II that the way that the church deals with modern issues, and environmentalism is one of those, as we were talking about. You don't find environmentalism in the works of St. Thomas or St. Augustine unless you're really digging deep and scratching, you know, scratching.
They wouldn't
well
have
beneath
the understanding
the
of it that we do.
Right, exactly.
Sure. Right.
But in dealing with modern issues, more and more of the responsibility is placed on the laity, and less and less of the responsibility for piecing these out is on the clergy. So when you go and you start to say, well, what's the Catholic answer? I think by that, most people are thinking, you know, what do the theologians say about this? What do the bishops say about this? And, you know, environmentalism is one of those where I think more and more it's going to be left to, no, what do Catholic scientists say about this? Really, that's ultimately the question.
I think that's part. I think that's right. As far as it goes, what I might add to that is that the Holy Fathers have, as well as the bishops, especially the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, do weigh in on environmental issues to give us to try. And this is the role of theology in the issue. I think is that to try to furnish us with the principles and understanding, especially something I know you and I like to talk a lot about, Mark, or refer to, which is that, you know, the things have purposes, and so. When we begin to raise and answer the questions around, well, what's the purpose of the earth? What's the purpose of natural resources? What's human beings' relationship as it pertains to God's creation? And I think that's where maybe the theological views begin to come in, and that those expressed by, say, members of the clergy. But to your point, though, when it comes to, say, the practical solving of these issues, moving from principle to practice, it really does fall on the shoulders of the laity in two different ways, I would say. One, the laity, as you mentioned, say members of, say, the scientific community as well as others. I mean, economists, I think, have a really important role to play in environmentalism.
Oh, certainly.
Because environmentalism is often tied up with the commercial society. But I would say more broadly, though, each person has, regardless, you know, has a kind of role in the stewardship, as Kent kind of led this show off with, in terms of the stewardship that each of us exercises over creation and the goods entrusted to us. So it really touches all of us.
Yeah, it touches all of us, and you're exactly right. Economists have a large amount to kind of contribute, I think, to this discussion of, you know, what are the purpose ultimately of the natural world around us? What's the purpose? Is it there to furnish us with more and more goods to lead to more and more wealth and more prosperity? Is it there to create a natural environment for the maximum amount of species that can live in a square area? Is it a mix of both? How do we decide which areas of the environment are meant for one and which are meant for the other? You know, all of these are questions that economists need to weigh in, scientists need to weigh in, but overarching, you're right, the central principles there do, to a certain extent, come from anthropology, which is informed by Catholic theology. Anthropology being kind of, what's the makeup of man? What is man's purpose, first and foremost, and how is that informed by a relationship with God? And then from that, we can kind of start to figure out, okay, so what should our relationship with the natural world around us be, and how do we start to address some of these more complex questions?
Yeah, I think one of the, maybe by way of example, one of the more complex issues, I think, of our current setting is, say, the practice of fracking. you know, where you there seems to be some trade-off decisions that are made there. So with fracking, you do seem to have quite a heavy environmental, negative environmental impact by the process of fracking on the sides of mountains and things like that. Using, you know, super high pressure water to force natural gas that's trapped below the surface and then have it captured and harvested and then used. But it seems to leave a lot of, I think the term I've heard is like sort of like scarring where fracking has taken place.
Yeah, and there's a lot of concern about pollution from the fracking process.
That water.
You're not just injecting water. You're injecting a chemical cocktail in there, a high-pressure chemical cocktail to try to break loose all of the, basically it's oil that has become solidified within the rock. So you're breaking up the rock and dissolving the rock all at once to kind of free the oil to be able to get out. There's also a geological impact from fracking as well that a lot of people are concerned about.
Seems to do a lot of damage to fresh drinking water that's under the surface.
Well, and the areas where there tend to be a lot of rock, you know, or a lot of oil contained in the rock that fracking would help with, those are areas that are very much dominated by limestone, which means in that area, you're talking about a lot of underground water sources. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about aquifers and things that, you know, as you start injecting chemicals into it.
Yeah, you're not going to drink that.
Right. And you know, Oklahoma, where they've had a lot of fracking activity, they've seen a huge amount of minor earthquakes increase. Coincidentally, scientists are still trying to, you know, investigate how much of the fracking and the breaking up of the rock and everything is causing contributing to that. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously an environmental impact by human activity on trying to extract this oil for us to use. So then the question becomes a question of, you know, what is the proper amount of impact that human beings should have? And as I said, you know, I think automatically saying that, you know, human beings' impact in an area is quote unquote unnatural, I think is making a presupposition. You know, it's making a presupposition that we're kind of aliens to this environment. And
yes,
and
we're exterior to the habitat.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're not part of it. You know, we're human beings imposing ourselves. We're not beavers. You know, they're doing things that, are part of the natural process, but might be, you know, harmful to other species or things like that.
Yeah, that's a really great point to mention, because it does often in environmentalism, there does seem to be in some of the literature I've read and articles I've read, there does seem to be a kind of radical strain of environmentalism that pits the earth against humanity and concludes that humanity is the problem.
Right. And it wasn't the environmentalists that came up with this, you know, pitting the natural world against humanity. In some ways, you can go back to the dawn of modern science and say, you know, it's the whole scientific program that kind of pits man against his environment. You know, Roger Bacon was one of the early philosophers that really, he propelled science forward.
Bacon.
And not to be confused with Francis Bacon, who's a different Bacon, different species of Bacon there.
Right.
But Roger Bacon, you know, his famous quote was, you know, that man needs to, you know, test and put, I think, put nature to the test and try to torture it, to bring about
you all. You sound like Dr. Redpath now.
Well, no, and Dr.
And he's right.
And Dr. Redpath, and he's pretty much quoting Roger Bacon when he says that, you know, we need to torture nature to make her reveal all her secrets to us.
Right.
Well, you know, obviously that's going to create an antithetical relationship between us and the natural environment.
Right, if you're going to torture an object to make it talk.
Yeah, you get this picture of these poor little woodland creatures and deer just like with great big eyes, fearing this scientist coming that's going to like lock it up and put it in a laboratory to try to figure out, you know, what makes it tick.
Yeah, I think something else that it calls to mind for me is, you know, we think about, you know, we think about like Aristotle and his four causes. It seems in the current modern setting where you have kind of secular atheistic scientism kind of ruling the day in many of these circles, that there's a hyper emphasis on both the efficient cause and the material cause. So the material cause of something being, you know, kind of what the stuff that it's made of. And then the efficient cause is like who or what is acting upon it to bring it about. And there's sort of a loss of the other two causes, especially the final cause, which speaks to purposes or that things have forms.
Yeah.
So the form and final cause have seem to have dropped out of the picture in favor of efficient and material causes.
Yeah, and particularly final cause, because mm-hmm. final cause is more than just, you know, what's its purpose, but it really is kind of what's its nature. You know, what is its tendency? You know, I think St. Thomas,
for a lot of things, formal right. and final causes are the same, especially non-spiritual objects.
Right, right. But, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas talks about the purpose of like flint. And when he talks about that, it's not, you know, what use you can put flint to, it's what its tendency is. You know, its tendency is to create sparks. Yeah. And so, you know, that really is kind of its final cause is to create sparks. Not that that's its purpose, but that's its tendency. That's what it naturally is going to do. That's what it's naturally going to produce. And so looking at nature as far as, okay, so you've got this rock, and is that rock naturally going to produce oil, or is that rock naturally going to produce diamonds? You know, that involves some scientific investigation, yep, obviously, sure, but that determination then really should in some ways guide how we use that rock.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And we'll take a look at just how we're going to process these rocks
right
after we take a break. This is the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
The selfish become generous.
The bitter become better.
The sinner discovers forgiveness.
And the creator of love is introduced.
It's known to happen here.
Positive change.
Catholic Radio Indy.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a ministry reaching out to Central Indiana and beyond. We have information available about what's happening in parishes here in the Hoosier Heartland, as well as access to the latest from Rome, plus apologetics and authentic Catholic teaching. We are your source for 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Most of us like to keep up on what's going on in the world and try to catch a little news each day. Did you know that you can catch the very latest Catholic news right on our website? We have news from Rome, from around the world, and here at home, updated every day so you always know what's going on from a Catholic perspective. Check it out. Go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and look for the Catholic news headlines. There's always something new at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
When you're tired of doing life alone, come back here. We enjoy the company. We hope you do too. Better. Together. Catholic Radio Indy.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell in the cave with our co-host Mark Tuttle, our producer Ken Blanford. We've been looking at environmentalism a little bit, both broadly speaking and now a little bit from a Catholic point of view. Mark, I know one place we want to go with this conversation is we always like talking about like first causes. So let's maybe turn the page back a little bit. And what's your thoughts on what's given rise to contemporary environmentalism? Where does this thing sort of begin from a philosophical standpoint?
Right, because as we were saying earlier, when you go back to St. Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine or some of the early Catholic philosophers,
you don't see in Dante's Inferno, you don't see like heretical environmentalists getting barbecued on like the third level of hell.
Exactly.
Or like that.
Yeah, and it's not like there wasn't pollution back then. And
And
I would even say it's not that pollution even wasn't a concern. I mean, you can go back and you can find in literature discussions of how filthy the streets of various cities were, mm-hmm. and you can find discussions of how, you know, certain practices might have contributed to certain plagues and things like that. So there was investigations going on, and there was, mm-hmm. Attempts to try to figure out certain environmental problems. I heard that, England was completely deforested.
Haiti suffer from that quite a bit?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. So there were environmental problems that people recognized as problems, mm-hmm. but they didn't see them in the same light that we do. It takes us getting to modern philosophy and sort of the break from scholasticism and traditional philosophy to modern thought for us to really get into, I think, a lot of the problems and a lot of the perspectives that environmentalism comes from. And that's because of, there's two things within modern philosophy that come up. One of them we talked about already, and that one's pretty obvious, that modern philosophy pits reason and rational processes and thought processes against matter. So there's a split between, as Descartes would say, res cogitans and material things. I forget what the Latin word was that he used for that, but
I'm impressed that you remember the first phrase. That's pretty cool.
But things of thought and things of matter. There's a strict separation between
that
those.
Kind of dualism.
A dualism, and modern thought, a lot of it was trying to overcome that.
Right.
So you had Descartes kind of introduce this, and everybody said, "Yeah, you're right. There is this sort of split between the world of thought and the world of matter. How do we reconcile the two?" And modern philosophy has been working on that problem in various ways ever since. But because of that split, you have this natural sort of antithetical relationship, I think, between the natural world and human purposes. What we're trying to do as human, our plans, our projects and things that we've created in our heads. There's a natural split there that's caused by modern philosophy.
Yeah, I think one of the other, tell me if you think I'm on the right track here. I'm going back to say Plato in the time of Plato, where at that time there was also a kind of split between the material and the spiritual in favor of the spiritual, the goal, we come into existence, or maybe we always existed as souls, then souls that become embodied, our souls are kind of trapped in our bodies during our lifetime, and then the goal is to sort of free it and return to a completely spiritual state. Environmentalism almost inverts that in my way of thinking, in that it puts the emphasis or the primacy of place, importance on the material world, even at the expense of, say, the spiritual, because it's saying this sort of, to coin another phrase, this sort of state of nature is to be, as you mentioned before, sort of to be left alone. The best thing we can do in terms of stewardship, according to some in the, I would say, more radical environmental movement, would be leave it alone.
Right. And I think that comes from the sort of the second big problem with modern thought from a Catholic perspective. And that's a lack of teleology. So, if you go back to Aristotle and you go back to St. Thomas Aquinas, one of the things that they talk a lot about is the purpose of mankind. What is man's purpose?
Right.
And what are we created for? And everything can be looked at from that perspective. Well, modern thought discards the idea, to a certain extent, of the idea that people have purposes. And that leads to materialism from the philosophical standpoint. And I would say, environmentalism is a materialistic reaction against the materialistic era of modern thought.
Oh, yeah. I could see that.
As people lose this concept that we have a purpose beyond this world, that our purpose is pretty much to increase pleasure and reduce pain, as the utilitarian philosophers would say.
Hedonism,
right. Etc. Then the natural environment, part of the purpose, the assumed purpose of it, is to contribute to that, to contribute to man's material needs and man's material existence. And environmentalism, as you said, is almost a reaction against that. It's kind of saying, no, the purpose of the earth is not to contribute to man's material well-being. Well, if you don't have a sense of man's spiritual well-being and the idea that, no, what we're trying to do is kind of create a harmonious relationship and be stewards, and we have a moral responsibility to the earth, if you kind of set that aside, then the purpose of the environment has nothing to do with humans. You know, human beings aren't part of the environment. We don't belong in the environment. And so human beings need to be kept.
Yeah, we're alienated from
it. We need to be kept out of it. Yeah. Right. You know, nature needs to be left to itself, and mankind needs to be kind of set aside. Yeah, I think that's a kind of a negative side of environmentalism. Mm-hmm. I think there's a positive side to that same movement that's probably a little more in line with Catholic thought. But, you know, looking at it, I guess, from a critical standpoint, you know, that's kind of where a lot of it comes from.
I would think, too, one of the other key features of the contemporary environmentalism would be that, in terms of where it maybe goes haywire, is it seems really kind of soaked in a Darwinian evolutionary trajectory for living creatures, such that it eclipses our final beatitude, our final destiny. It cuts off teleology to a large extent. And then relegates humanity as a kind of in a certain, like you're saying, in a certain sense, just sort of like an interferer with these other natural processes. And that the person, you know, if someone's interfering with something, you usually want to stop them.
Right. And it's not just Darwinianism. I mean, there's a lot of other natural processes that man is seen as somebody that is naturally going to manipulate it. Whether we're manipulating it in a positive way.
The word you use to exploit.
Yeah, we're exploiting it. Right, exactly.
And when we use words like that, I mean, that's where if you think someone's exploiting someone, we tend to want to. And it sort of arouses a sort of moral indignation. We want to stop exploitation.
Right. And there's a recognition of human hubris involved in that as well. That as we become more and more scientifically inclined and we become more and more knowledgeable about how the environment works, we become more and more inclined to try to interfere and manipulate. One of the classic, I think, environmental blunders in the view of the environmentalists, and I mean, I think the view of most people, is the attempt to eradicate forest fires. You know, forest fires, from our scientific viewpoint, you know, we saw that, you know, they were harmful, you know, because
things burn to the ground.
Things burn to the ground. Bambi no longer has a home.
That is sad.
Bambi.
Because everybody loves Bambi.
Right. Bambi has to go find somewhere
Bambi
else.
Bambi tastes like chicken, too.
And so, you know, there was this massive environmental movement, and it really was an environmentalist type of movement.
Oh, yeah.
To try to prevent all forest fires from happening.
Right.
Well, you know, when you look at it from a more ecological perspective, that allows the undergrowth to grow much more
thicker.
There are certain trees that rely on fires to germinate. Mm-hmm. And so it prevents the germination of some of these large, you know, like the giant sequoias and other large trees.
Right.
It prevents them from reproducing. And so you wind up with this smaller, weaker, more undergrowthy type of forest. Mm-hmm. Which leads to much more devastating forest fires when they occur. And so
I can give you a quick example. So in 1995, my younger brother got married, and they in Wyoming. And so I drove to Wyoming and went to the wedding, and I always wanted to see Yellowstone. And so I added a couple of extra days to my trip after the wedding to camp. Couldn't actually get in Yellowstone. It was full, but right next to it, so it all looks the same. It was beautiful. But I did go through Yellowstone, and that was maybe 5 or 6 years or so after they had a massive forest fire for the reason you just mentioned. They had been putting them out, catching them early, and that just caused all that undergrowth of like pine needles to just get super thick. So when it finally did ignite and they couldn't stop it, what really became problematic is it burned so much hotter because of all of that tinder, and then therefore the natural processes of how forest fires often lead to sort of like a renewal and growth over time, there's a natural kind of cycle to it, was thwarted because it had burned so hot, it killed a lot of those necessary ingredients in the topsoil. So man's interference, that's a good example of where we kind of interfered to stop something natural like a forest fire, just simply created a whole worse set of circumstances.
Right. And the point isn't so much that we know better now, but the point is we're hubristic enough that we always are going to think we know better. Right. I mean, even the idea that, well, okay, therefore we need to have controlled fires and therefore we need to let the fires go a little bit more. That may not be the right approach either. You know, I think there's a certain amount of, you know, we're always going to be trying to figure out how it works, and we're always going to be trying to manipulate things better to make the forest take care of itself better. And I think one of the points of environmentalism is mankind just by nature is going to be hubristic like that. We're always going to be, you know, trying to come up with the magic ingredient, the magic key, the magic way to make the environment better. And, you know, that's almost always going to backfire.
Yeah, that's I think it involves prudential judgments by people. You know, human beings were prone to making mistakes, so right. that's sort of inherent in the right. process.
And you know, that kind of humility and understanding our relationship as one of many of God's creatures, but yet a creature with a specific role and a specific responsibility to the earth and the environment. I think that's one area where Catholic thought can really come in and help add to this discussion.
And we'll take a look at the Catholic view of our role and our responsibility with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kip Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, we were talking forest fires just before the break. And one of the things that, you know, is in the news these days is the fact that there are intentional burnings of, you know, the jungle and the forest areas in Brazil. Now, 200 years ago, that could have been going on, and we here in North America never would have known about it. You know, we have more of a global village these days. Now, do we have a responsibility here in North America to deal with those things that are going on in Brazil? You know, are we as Catholics required to look at the entire world or just our world?
You know, setting aside the question of moral responsibility for a minute, even just the awareness to a certain extent of the interconnectedness of everything is very much a contemporary sort of discovery. I mean, you know, Heisenstein's uncertainty principle, you know, where, you know, one thing that happens in the Amazonian jungle is going to affect something all the way across the globe,
right?
Just because of the nature of the way everything fits together. You know, that's something that is very much a piece of, well, not even modern thought, but more postmodern thought in some ways. So, you know, us reconciling with that, I think you're right. I think that's been a huge contributor to environmentalism and that sort of awareness that, no, we can't just let fires in the jungles of Brazil burn without expecting it to affect, you know, the number of dolphins in the oceans or something like that.
You know, we have historically occasions where something that happened completely on the opposite side of the world affected, you know, the European continent. For example, the eruption of Krakatoa. Years and years and years ago, Krakatoa explodes. It's the world, you know, as far as we know, the world's largest volcanic eruption at least in the history of mankind, and we end up with a very cold, almost, you know, winterish summer in Europe. What affects, you know, one side of the world can affect the other side of the world. We just didn't know about it back then.
Right. We wouldn't be able to put it together. I don't think, so as you're mentioning, like, so like a, so someone in the medieval period, for example, would have no good way of knowing that, say, the Amazon basin is geographically responsible for the, you know, a large production of oxygen that we breathe. And so by destroying it through destroying it or over harvesting, let's say, the Amazon rainforest, you risk oxygen production for the entire planet. And that's a kind of global concern that we just weren't aware of until fairly recently.
Right. And so I think that brings into into play a lot of the economic side of environmentalism to a certain extent. You know, it comes from this recognition that all things are interconnected. And so therefore, our individual choices, that's the stuff of economics, mm-hmm. Affects the whole globe. So it's not just my consumer choices affecting me and my family, but those are affecting things far beyond just my little sphere.
Yeah, there's a kind of aggregation to what you're talking about where obviously one person's individual choices, unless it's something extremely radical, like, unleashing, say, radioactive material into a stream. Most of us don't have access to that or have no plans of doing that. It's the aggregate of our choices, you know, that add up. And I think there is some, obviously, some effort on a global scale. There are treaties that are, you know, created and entered into and then maybe removed or negated that and deal with sort of what we call maybe waste production or pollution production. Or there's an effort that died a few years ago, cap and trade, you know, where you sort of put a cap on how much, you know, carbon dioxide or certain kinds of emissions and an industry would produce. And then you'd trade these carbon emissions around. So there are some efforts made both, I guess, domestically, but also internationally to try to understand, because you have a bit like a large developing country like China. Industrialization will produce a whole lot of environmental impact, mostly seen as negative.
Right. And that brings in a whole bunch of concerns around justice and social justice as well. Yeah. You know, to what extent are developed countries allowed to continue to, you know, create the pollution and things? And meanwhile, you know, it takes a certain while for you to get to a point of industrialization where you can start to cut down on your emissions. So these non-developed countries, to what extent are we allowed as developed countries to say, well, I'm sorry, you just can't even start the process?
Yeah, you're stuck in poverty or that lower, right, much lower standard of living.
So you wind up with these huge number of different disciplines needing to come together to address some of these problems, talk about these problems, figure them out, and kind of figure out what the best approaches are. And that's why I think everybody coming to the table needs to be coming with a good recognition.
You all need to be Catholic, Mark.
Well, that's a little bit of where I was going. You know?
At last!
You know, Catholic.
Someone called me a Catholic snob not too long ago, so I'm eager to prove my bona fide.
Well, I don't think it's Catholic snobbery. You know,
I'm kidding.
I think there's a treasury of Catholic thought that we can rely on, that I think does start to shed a light on a lot of these from a perspective that puts man in his proper place as a fellow creature along with all the mm-hmm. other creatures, but a creature that has been endowed with reason and has been given, as part of why we were created, a responsibility to be good stewards and caretakers of the rest of creation.
Right. There's a couple of quick things I'll mention, because I know we'll be out of time for the show before you know it. One would be, I bring up this Catholic notion of, it's not limited to Catholic viewpoint, but it's this universal destination of goods, that although we certainly affirm private property, there is something even more fundamental, that at the end of the day, even my private property really doesn't belong to me. We see them as gifts that have been given to us and entrusted to us by God himself.
Right, right. And I think also Catholic thought, Catholic social teaching gives us a huge tool towards sorting out, you know, the little catchphrase of, you know, think globally, act locally. You know, Catholic social teaching has this concept of subsidiarity.
Well, you're risking Marxist sloganeering when you do that.
Well, it's actually, I mean, it's environmental sloganeering. So we're talking about environmental.
Which is often Marxist.
Well, the reason
that's a whole other show.
It is, but the reason it's often Marxist is because, as we said, you know, these do tend to turn into global problems.
Yeah.
And Marxism is a flawed approach towards trying to have a sense of kind of global responsibility.
Totalitarian sphere.
But the Catholic notion of subsidiarity is a much better notion than Marxism.
Right.
And when people think of subsidiarity, they think of localism. You know, they think of trying to boil everything down to the most local level. That's not what subsidiarity actually says.
Right.
Subsidiarity says, you know, there are problems that can be solved at the local level, but when they go beyond that, you have these concentric spheres of responsibility, where then you've got the higher levels only talking about those questions that seem to affect them. And that's where, you know, the role of the UN comes in and creating some of these treaties. But what they're addressing by Catholic thought would be limited. It would be limited by what's being able to be addressed at the national level, at the state level, at the local level. And so the solutions start with local action, but that limiting that subsidiarity puts into place really, I think, protects the whole process from spinning out of control into something like Marxism.
Right. I think the other thing I want to mention, too, before we run out of time is going back to sort of a theological point to share, which is that as Catholics, we understand that we're in a fallen world. And I think it's Chesterton who, and it's others, but Chesterton, as I recall, mentioning that, you know, the hallmark of being able to believe in the Christian faith is original sin. So whenever we tackle these really complicated problems, it seems to me what's going to be caught up in it is a kind of fallibility in our judgment, our reasoning, decision-making. So we're going to make plenty of mistakes as we try to be or fulfill our responsibility and duty to be good stewards of the earth.
Right. And finally, and I would say probably most importantly, as Catholics, we understand that the dualism is only apparent. Mm-hmm. That this idea that there is a spiritual, mental, realm of ideas and thoughts, and separate from that and antagonistic to that is the material world that we're trying to put into play to fit into our schemes and our ideas, that's only apparent. And that what happens physically affects what happens spiritually. And that the path road to spiritual health really is based a lot of ways on physical health and vice versa. You know, healthy spiritual thought, healthy thought patterns, healthy ways of life lead to a healthy environment, and they lead to a relationship that isn't antagonistic, but is harmonious. That idea is baked into Catholic thought, and I think adds a great deal of perspective into a lot of these debates that arise when you start talking about the environment.
Right, and it to emphasize that too, it's helpful maybe to remember that. We often hear, in terms of our primary concern as Catholics, primary concern of Holy Mother Church is what the salvation of souls, right? And that that's a reminder as to the spiritual goods and the importance that plays, and not in a way as you rightly point out, Mark, that separates or divides the body from the soul, but remembering that at the end of the day, what we're called to is beatitude.
Exactly. You know, overconsumption isn't just an environmental problem, or doesn't just cause environmental problems. Overconsumption causes spiritual problems as well. And so, you know, when you start to address the spiritual problems, you're simultaneously going to be addressing the material problems that result from them.
Well, you know, one thing too I want to mention, I know people sometimes want to know kind of resources. Obviously, the Catechism of the Catholic Church is a great resource. One that I have with me today, I would also mention, is it's called the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church. And you can equip yourself with a lot of the principles that we've been kind of talking about and sharing in the program today. I also like the USCCB.org website, because you can access a lot of great materials that's been produced by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
And those are great resources you could tap into between now and the next time you listen to The Catholic Cave. That's all the time we have for today. For Mark Tuttle, for Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford. Until the next time, be holy. The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.